Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Good morning and welcome to All Sides Weekend, and this is The Book Show. I'm Christopher Purdy, delighted to have you with us. We are going to talk about the latest great reads, quick picks from the Columbus Library, books that you should know about, books maybe that you don't need to know about. With our panel, Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. It's important to anyone who loves to read. Michelle Herman is Professor Emerita of English Creative Writing at The Ohio State University. She is an author with a new book out. We're going to talk about that in a moment. A teacher, a writer, a dancer. And Chris Hickey is here. She also dances. You can dance with me sometime. That'd be not good for you. Chris Hickey is the Youth Services Manager at the Whetstone Branch of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And Chris Hickey brings us quick picks every month. Those are the books that everybody wants to read. And there's a line that Chris Hickey will tell you how to skip. I am going to ask Cassie Rose to start with us with a recommendation of a book for us.
I will start with a book called Watching Over Her by Jean-Baptiste Andrea, which is a wonderful book. It's got adventure in it. It's gripping. And also it has kind of a philosophical underbelly, I will say. It starts out with a man named Mimmo. He's a sculptor, and he is dying in an Italian monastery, and all the monks are surrounding him. And they do not know his story. He's been there for about 40 years, and he's never talked about his life. And they have a feeling that he does want to start talking about it now. Now, he didn't come to the monastery alone. He came with a sculptor, the Pietà, that he had created of the Mother Mary with Jesus. And it has to remain under lock and key. And we don't know why, but we do know that people that come to see it become very emotional. And so the reason for that is what we discover as we read the book. And what we get of his life is how, when he was a young boy, his mother sent him to Italy to apprentice with sculptors. And he doesn't really get the instruction. I mean, he has a prodigious talent, but he's put really on the work floor. And with the first one, he is on the estate of the Orsinis, a noble family, and he meets their teenage girl, and they become cosmic twins. It's not a romance like you would think it would be, but what's extraordinary about both of these characters is that they are odd, and that is the girl has a photographic memory, and she is brilliant about science. She is outspoken, and this is, you know, in the early 20th century. This is not something that is modern. And for Mimmo, he is under 5 feet, so he is often mocked for being a dwarf, and then the other sculptors get jealous of him. Now, he does lead a life of debauchery and self-sabotage.
In the monastery?
In Florence. Oh. This is when he's a young boy. So, and all of that is, you know, you get involved in that because you love this character. You love Mimmo. You think he's just going to take himself down, but he doesn't. And there's something magical about that. And I think that all of us can sort of relate to and say, I'm going to go against the grain. I am going to just, damn it, do it for what I want to do. Anyway, we see him reach his glory. And this is during World War II. And so he also, the Orsini family, he's kept in touch with them. And one of the members of the family has become a priest at the Vatican. And that man gives him entrance to a lot of work for himself. I want to share just a moment, like one of the a scene, which will give you a sense of this book in a way. During his debauchery years, or when he is still struggling, he joins the circus. And this is in Florence. And it is owned by a man named Bizarro. And you can just, they, you know, do what they do in the circus in the day, and at night they are out drinking, they're singing with the sailors, opera, arias, everything.
This
they
is an just, opera. You're talking.
You're right. It is. And when he has, when Mimo has become famous and he's about ready to get an award, Bizarro shows up. And this is during World War II. Italy is a fascist country. And Bizarro is asking for his help because his sister is in an internment camp and he wants Mimo to help get her out so she isn't transported. And, you know, Mimo's like, what are you going to do? Are you going to blackmail me? Tell about all the stuff going on. Are you going to put a knife in me? And this guy Bizarro says, no. He says, because I believe someday you are going to get to a point where you will realize your conscience is more valuable than your very expensive watch here. And he says, you will also realize that you cannot buy your conscience back. And at that moment, there's a great turning point in the book. It won the Prix Goncourt in France, which is their equivalent to our Pulitzer Prize and England's the Booker Prize. It's really terrifically good. And I will tell you that you do need to get in about 20 pages of it to let it take off, because it's the monastery part that is sort of trying to set the stage. And you really don't have a sense of where it's going and that involvement that's going to start. But it does end also with the monks at the end, and you do understand why he's there with the statue.
It's called Watching Over Her, and the author is?
Jean-Baptiste Andrea.
That is a recommendation from Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic. Her blog, thelongestchapter.com, very important and entertaining for everyone who loves to read. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books. Chris Hickey is going to give us a quick pick. First of all, tell us what a quick pick, remind us what a quick pick is.
Quick picks are the hottest books. They're the books that have the long hold lists. And the idea is that you can walk into one of our buildings. You may have this book on hold and it is sitting there on a display. You can check it out and you can jump the line.
So
I am going to talk about Matt Dinneman. So he's one of those, if you know, you know, authors. He is beloved. He has a cult following. When he came to the Columbus Book Festival last year, it just, so many people came to see him, and he was gracious, and he signed as much as he could. He's wonderful. This is the first time I've read him. This is his brand new book called Operation Bounce House. So if you've read his Dungeon Crawler Carl series, this book is also funny, but not as funny. So Matt Dinneman, he's a sci-fi author, and he likes to start with a character. He likes them to be normal people, almost slackers. And so Oliver lives on a planet called New Sonora with his sister Lulu, and they run a farm that was started by his grandfather. Now, they're like an Earth colony planet. So his grandfather arrived. He was born on a generation ship and started this farm with the help of these honeybee robots, which are controlled by a hive queen AI entity named Roger. They call him Roger Roger. They call him Roger for short. And Oliver's in a band called the Rhythm Mafia. They're not a good band, but that's just makes it even funnier. So he's just trying to live his life. He has a girlfriend. Maybe he's going to marry her. He doesn't know what's wrong with him, that he hasn't done it already. One day he and his friends discover a killer robot lands. And
A killer robot lands
on the planet and starts shooting at them. And the voice that comes from this robot is a child's voice. And they're able to take out the robot, but they're like, what's going on? They discover that planet Earth wants the planet back. And so they are using warfare as entertainment. And so people, gamers, are spending great amounts of money to outfit these robots and sending them to the planet. They are calling them terrorists, like the people on this planet. They're farmers, and they're being called terrorists so that the people of Earth aren't sorry for wiping them out.
The killer robots are called terrorists?
No,
the children, Oliver.
I'm sorry. I'm not being clear. So Oliver.
It's a quick pick. Read it already. Get in line. Everybody wants to read this book. No one understands it, but they want to read
it. It's an incredible book. It is about how we treat each other when there's a screen in between. And the AI discussion of this, because Roger is fascinating. He's not sure how he feels about humanity, and he's also their teacher. So the grandfather programmed him. So when they say swear words, he zaps them. But it's going to make you think some deep thoughts. It's dark. It's a very dark and upsetting book, but it's also funny, and it is Matt Dinneman, and Matt Dinneman is just Matt Dinneman, and
you don't argue with something that has a huge waiting list for it.
Yes, so it's excellent.
That's a quick pick from...
I can argue with that, but I won't.
Chris, that's a quick pick from Chris Hickey at the Columbus Metropolitan Library. And you said Matt Dinneman, when he was here, was it last year, sold a place out.
Yes, people waited in line. Not everyone got to see him, but his fans are so lovely. They were gracious about it. Mm.
Very good. Thank you very much, Chris Hickey. Now, Michelle Herman has a new book out, which you're going to tell us about.
So this book is actually something I wrote for my daughter when she was 8 years old, because she had just read Little Women, and she came to me and said, it's not fair that the Marmee's daughters all got a guide to life. Where's my guide to life? Now, of course, if you remember Little Women, that was Pilgrim's Progress that Marmee gave her children as a guide to life. But as a very obedient and devoted mother, I wrote my daughter a guide to life. Wrote it, gave it to her, forgot about it. Many years later, when she was leaving for college and I was helping her go through her shelves, I found it. My agent at the time said, this is great, and it was published as A Girl's Guide to Life with minimal changes and a foreword by my then 18, 19-year-old daughter. Recently, the publisher came to me and said, do you want to update that book? And I was thrilled, because today I would never write A Girl's Guide to Life. I would never have gendered it. And so I went back into the manuscript, and A Kid's Guide to Life was born. It's free of gender, and I don't know why I ever thought it had to be gendered to begin with, except that, of course, it had been written for my little girl child. It's longer. There's more anecdotes. They've modernized it with adorable new illustrations. And its official date of birth is March 9th, which is my birthday, which I kind of love. But we are launching it in Columbus on March 7th at the wonderful Cover to Cover bookstore. So if you're around, come and join us at 1 o'clock on Saturday, March 7th.
Is part of the updating that you did related to technology that didn't exist when you first wrote?
Absolutely not. So my purpose in the book was to really still have it be timeless. The book really revolves around basic concepts like the Golden Rule and empathy, which is, of course, related to the Golden Rule. Things like asserting yourself and saying no. And there are suggestions, I guess, about all of this, because there's a lot of talk about things that people do that may not be healthy to do, and learning how to navigate that. It's meant for kids 8, 9, 10 years old. It doesn't go into matters of romance or sex. There's a gesture toward it at the end, but it's really for that specific age group.
Do you address anything like bullying?
I do.
Good. Yeah.
You know, when my agent first suggested we publish it, I typed up a manuscript version, and I gave copies of it to all the children I knew who were 8, 9, and 10, and got suggestions back. And they were very helpful, because, of course, since that book was for my daughter, I had not included a section on how to make new friends, because she wasn't shy. And one little girl said, oh, please, I don't know how. You say make new friends, but you don't tell me how. Mm. So I got a lot of that, although my favorite response was from my friend, the writer Dan Coyes's daughter, who at the time was 9, who said, I quote, okay, I get it already. She doesn't have to repeat the same thing over and over again in different words, which I have been told all my life. You know, she's now freshly a college graduate, so that's how much time has passed.
Do I understand correctly that your daughter has written the introduction?
Yes, she has written a foreword, and bonus, she will be in Columbus on Saturday, March 7th. She's coming to town for my birthday, and will be at the event with me, which I'm very excited.
Cover to Cover is a lovely store.
It is a wonderful store.
It's a lovely store. Yes, yes. Good to know about that. That is a new book from Michelle Herman. Tell me the title again.
A Kid's Guide to Life.
March 7th, what time?
1 p.m.
Cover to Cover bookstore in Upper Arlington.
Yes.
We are going to take a break and come back in about a minute for more of All Sides Weekend, the book show. Don't go away.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
We are back, All Sides Weekend, the book show. I'm Christopher Purdy with Chris Hickey, Cassie Rose, and Michelle Herman. I want to let everybody know, Sunday evening, our own Amy Jurevich, the host of All Sides, will interview Will Haygood, the author, about his new book, The War Within a War, The Black Struggle in Vietnam and at Home. This is at the Drexel Theater in Bexley. It's part of a presentation of Gramercy Books. If you would like tickets, go to wosu.org/events or visit the Gramercy Books website. Amy Jurevich is the interviewer for Will Haygood, Sunday night at the Drexel in Bexley. So, well, Michelle, let's have a book that we should read. We'll read yours after March 7th, but what are we reading now?
So I just finished reading Strangers, A Memoir of Marriage. I've got it on my iPad because I downloaded the sample and then I thought, oh my God, I've got to read this entire book right now. I can't wait for it to come in from the library. So Belle Burden is the author of the book. It's her first book, but I suspect it will not be her last book. She is a blue blood. Her father was Carter Burden, who is a Vanderbilt. And her mother is Amanda Burden, who is a Mortimer and a Paley. Her grandmother, Belle Burden's grandmother, is Babe Paley. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating book. I first learned that it existed because it began as a modern love essay in the New York Times. And the Sunday New York Times, the best thing about the Sunday New York Times, as far as I'm concerned, is the modern love essay. And there was an amazing essay about this blue blood marriage suddenly ending. It was one of these stories where one day her husband is a loving husband. He's just bought a new mattress. The next day he says, I thought I was happy, but I'm not. And he leaves and he says he doesn't want anything. He doesn't want custody of the children. He doesn't want to share custody. He is just done. One of the things that's fascinating about this book is that Belle Burden is, given her background, very reserved, very private. And her decision to write about this in itself is almost is a narrative thread in the book. Everyone in her world is very shocked by her writing about it. But she's simultaneously exploring this thing that I think we've all experienced one way or another at some point in our life where someone you think you know fully does something so shocking that you cannot accommodate how this person could be the person you thought you'd known for years, and which is why the book is called Strangers. And she details it. She talks a lot about all the events leading up to her marriage. She talks about the marriage and the raising of her children and everything that happens in the wake of his suddenly leaving. To compound the trauma of this, he does this at the beginning of COVID so that she is quite isolated with her children and he is completely heartless. The only detail she changes in the book is the name of the husband. It seems that all the rest of it is absolutely true, and it's very easy to find out who
the husband
was.
You can look at the New York Times and
easily
find out his name.
Yes. Yeah. I've never heard of him, but he's a prominent person. Anyway, it just, I don't do this very much anymore, but I started reading the book one day last week, and I was so engrossed that I just canceled everything I was going to do that day and spent the day on the couch and just read the whole book. So it's that gripping. It's a little, you know, if you read Joan Didion's memoirs, as gorgeous as they are, like The Year of Magical Thinking, which is, I think, one of the great books of the of the last century, it's hard not to sometimes get uncomfortable about the casual name dropping and the level of entitlement. And you just have to get past that. In this book, the same is true. The difference, I think, is that Joan Didion never even seemed aware of how rarefied her life was. She never really quite understood how uncomfortable it might be for the rest of us. Belle Burden is fully aware that her life was gilded. I mean, she lived in multi-million dollar homes in Manhattan and, you know, summer homes and all of that. And Even the fact that the marriage is almost a 50s marriage. She is an accomplished lawyer. And when she gets married, she just, they never discussed it. She stopped working. Her job was to run the household and take care of the children. And she let him handle all the finances. So she doesn't know anything about her money. She put his name on everything.
It was her money, too.
It was her money.
Right.
She bought their apartment in Manhattan, but she put his name on it. It's really chilling because he seems like a sociopath. Anyway, great book. So I highly recommend it if you're in the mood for that sort of thing.
I just wrote that down. I think I am getting in the mood for that. Strangers by Bill Burton.
Yes.
Recommended for us by Michelle Herman on All Sides Weekend, the book show. Cassie Rose, how are we doing? Top that. Let's get a messy divorce or something.
I am going to talk about a book called, it's another novel, Mule Boy by Andrew Krivok. And it's about a coal mine disaster in Pennsylvania coal country in 1929.
I love this show, too.
We could not be more varied.
All right, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Right. So, on New Year's Day, 1929, and this is fiction, a 13-year-old boy named Andro is going to the mine. He's been working there as a nipper first, then as a spragger, but today he's been promoted to the mule boy. And these are all Slovak immigrants. Andrew Krivok often writes about the Slovak community. So they're waiting to go down into the shaft. They do, and there is Andro is in a room with four men, and the roof collapses. And the book is about the disaster, but it is narrated by Andro when he is an old man and he's in New Hampshire in a house beside a pond. So it is not only about the disaster and what happened and why he alone survived, but it's also about the burden that he carries of the guilt, the fear of death, and throughout his life. And this book is beautifully done. Beautifully done because of the way that the author interconnects these two worlds, as well as, you know, the disaster, his life growing up, and also as the old man who is by the pond and he is waiting. He knows that the children of the men and the grandchildren of the men will find him to ask questions. So during his lifetime, I mean, I won't go through the details of it, but there is a point where he ends up in prison. And he ends up in prison because he refuses to fight in World War II. And he refuses because there is a situation right after the disaster where schoolboys were taunting him, and he just broke the bone. He became enraged because they were telling sick jokes about the disaster, and I'll just sort of leave it at that. And he just breaks the face of one boy, and he vows never to be violent again. So in prison, though, he meets a man named Jacobson, and Jacobson essentially saves him from the guilt, saves him from the burden, and he does it by teaching him the wisdom of ancient philosophers and also the Book of Jonah. And there are moments in the book, like, for example, Jacob says to him at one point, he says, which of the men died with dignity? Which of the men died with happiness? And that takes Andro aback, but it does open him up. And he talks to Jacobson for the first time. And then there's another time where Jacobson says to him, he said, they died. They knew that they were dying. And Andro turns around and he goes, no, they wanted to get out. And Jacobson says, no, they wanted you to get out. Because, you see, Andro wasn't injured, and the other four were, and they knew that they were dying. Those moments in the prison and with Jacobson are a meditation on what you could say memento mori, if you know what that is. And for us as readers, it's enlightening. It is... It's not fascinating. It's just enlightening because he is speaking to this not having the fear of death and not having the fear of darkness. And that's where Andro then gets lifted up. And by the time that the children and the grandchildren come to find him, he is able to talk with them and to tell them what the men said, their last words, what they were feeling, what it was like to be in that darkness. And it is just, it's a stunning book. And towards the end, there is a hopefulness, and you get this sense of that he himself is also at peace. And the key is also is that Jacobson wanted him to know that he, like Jonah, was the messenger. And he wants him to know. And, you know, at that time, he's probably in his 40s or so. And when he gets out of prison, he works in New Hampshire in the forest as a ranger. But he comes to understand that he is, like Jonah was, the messenger, but also like Jonah, he was running from it.
Tell us, remind us of the title and the author.
The title is Mule Boy, and it's by Andrew Krivok. And I have read many of Andrew Krivok's books, and he is an extraordinary author.
That's a recommendation from Cassie Rose, who was WOSU's book critic. This is All Sides Weekend. This is the book show. And let's have another quick pick from our own Chris Hickey from the Columbus Library.
Your book sounded so hopeful.
Yeah.
And this one, I'm going to describe this book, and it couldn't be more different, but it is hopeful in its own way. It's called Half His Age by Jeanette McCurdy. Okay, so this is basically a book about grooming written by a former child star. So Jeanette McCurdy, she was on Nickelodeon. She wrote the memoir, I'm Glad My Mom Died. So this is not another memoir. This is a novel. So this novel is about a 17-year-old girl. Her name is Waldo, and she starts a relationship with her writing teacher. But that's not the whole story. So we get a very well-developed character in Waldo. And Waldo's mother is a hot mess. And if you've read McCurdy's memoir, you know that there's a lot to mine from in her own personal life. There's also a theme of consumerism. So how Waldo deals with her stuff is she's a shopping addict. So McCurdy kind of goes in depth on that as well. So the teacher is kind of a loser. So Waldo has agency. But she's not sure, am I attracted to this man or am I being manipulated? He's a loser. He's not very mature, and he's gross. And so McCurdy really drives the point home how sad this whole thing is. It's just sad. You are supposed to be very uncomfortable as you read this book. But Waldo is a talented writer, and she has agency. And so when McCurdy wrote her, she wanted to make sure that she had the agency that McCurdy herself didn't have at that same age. And she's just learning how to have that as a 33-year-old. She says, I listened to this great interview with her. She says she writes from a place of rage. So she's very direct in this book. And she talks a lot about the patriarchy and how it impacts these different characters, whether the characters know it or not. So this book is polarizing. So people who write reviews, book talk on TikTok, you either love this book or you hate this book. There's really no middle ground.
So did you love it or hate it?
I'm a little skeeved out.
did you read a previous book? Because that got a lot of attention.
Book. Her previous book was very dark but fascinating. So this is different because it's made up. But
the previous book was autobiographical, she's a decent writer. And this is a novel.
Yes, this is a novel.
Sounds like it's very multi-layered.
It is multi-layered. She goes deep, so
This is not a fun easy. Yeah. Give us another one that's for the couch.
For the couch?
Yeah.
Oh, how about a book about wonderful revenge?
Oh, good.
Oh, let's go. This is delicious revenge. So this is Freda McFadden, and this is the first time I've read her. She's a bestseller. She wrote The Housemaid. She's all over the place. This is her new one, and it is called Dear Debbie. And it's about a woman who is a housewife, but she is also like a Dear Abby advice columnist. And she has a file, and we read some of her essays. And they take an interesting dark turn. So, for example, the first one we come across, you know, someone is saying, how can I get my family to eat breakfast? And so she gives, you know, the normal kind of advice, you know, nutrients, things they like, blah, blah, blah. And then she says, and another thing you can do is you can padlock the front and back door and not let them out. So she takes a dark turn. This is the long game of revenge. So she's been planning things for years, and she goes after everybody. I mean, it's highly implausible, but it doesn't matter. This book is really fun. It's dark, but there's one really fun moment where she takes revenge on her snooty book club. And I think a lot of people will enjoy that part. It's she's known for her twists, and I did not see the twist coming. So I think this is going to be a fun one. If you like Freda McFadden, so many of my coworkers just adore her and just pour through her books. It's a quick read. It's kind of like Patterson, where it's not a super deep book, but it's quick, it's fast. You will be entertained the whole time.
Freda McFadden's Dear Debbie.
Dear Debbie.
This is Ann Landers on steroids, or, you know.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Ann Landers with a grudge.
With a grudge. Oh, well, I like that
even
better.
That sounds fun. It is fun.
That sounds like fun. That's a recommendation from Chris Hickey, who was the youth services manager at the Whetstone branch of the Columbus Metropolitan Library. That is a quick pick. And Michelle Herman, what do you have for us?
So I've got something that's literary and fun. You know, I am the queen of literary. Well, I don't know. Cassie may be the queen of literary. But so this is also a new book. It's a debut novel, All That Life Can Afford by Emily Everett. And honestly, I guess it's not a quick pick. If it doesn't look familiar to you, it must not be. But I did find it maybe in the new book section of the library, and I just picked it up out of curiosity. I hadn't heard of it, even though it's a Reese's Book Club pick. I clearly don't pay attention to that sort of thing. So this is a really charming, delightful book. It's described as effervescent by multiple reviewers. It's a coming-of-age story about a young woman who is studying Jane Austen, writing a dissertation on Jane Austen. And it's not a retelling of any single Austen novel, but it's kind of a retelling of Austen's tropes. Anna is a young woman who grew up in abject poverty. Food stamps, hand-me-downs, really, really hard scrabble life, and fell in love with Jane Austen as a child in her library, and, you know, manages to escape the town and escape her father and go to college on scholarship. But she's always an outsider. And ultimately, she ends up in London. Her dream is to live in London, of course. And she gets in very much the mode of Austen. She gets taken up by a rich family. And thus begins a tale of deceit, and all kinds of complications ensue. And ultimately she is exposed as the poor tutor of the rich family when she has been pretending otherwise. And it's full of surprises. It's got, you know, a romance that has lots of twists and turns, just like in Austen. It's not, by any means, is it Jane Austen level writing or conception, but it's charming, it's delightful, and I read it again. Last week was a big week for reading for me. I read it in just a couple of sittings with great pleasure. So that is All That Life Can Afford by Emily Everett.
That's a recommendation from Michelle Herman. This is All Sides Weekend Books. We are going to take a break and come right back. We are back. This is All Sides Weekend Books. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is The Book Show with Cassie Rose, WOHU's book critic, Michelle Herman, who was a writer and educator, and Chris Hickey, who brings us quick picks from the Columbus Metropolitan Library, where you are on staff for a long time, in one of the jewels of the community, by the way, which everybody knows. The whole library system is magnificent, but we all love Whetstone because some of us are lucky enough to be able to walk there. All right, I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to go ahead and ask. Apparently, there's a shortage of men in Columbus. I heard you talking.
There's no shortage of men, but there is definitely a shortage of good ones.
I heard you talking off mic, so maybe you and Chris Hickey, when she gets a minute, could share with us a story behind that remark.
Me? I'm up? Oh, you want me to now give a story about that remark?
Did I point at you or what?
Yes,
go ahead.
I got you.
Talk.
So I'm watching Love is Blind, which this season is set in Ohio. It was originally announced as Love is Blind Columbus, and I did my best to try to persuade all my single friends. Oh, Love is Blind is a phenomenon. I can't believe everyone listening to this show knows what it is, but I will tell you for Christopher's sake. It's a fantastic reality show concept where they go to a city, usually it's a single city, and it's a very heteronormative show. It's men and women, and the idea is they go into pods and they spend 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 hours at a time talking to each other, one man, one woman, with a panel between them, and they cannot see each other.
Men,
they can only hear
that.
Each other. Well, that may be one of the reasons they have trouble getting enough good. Anyway, they talk to each other over a period of many days, and then they fall in love. I mean, it's possible to fall in love with someone without seeing them if you're just exchanging your deepest secrets. And if you feel you've really fallen in love, the man will ask the woman to marry him sight unseen, and then there's a reveal. Then the next day or whenever, they get to see each other for the first time, and they find out if love really is blind. One of the constructs of the show is, so they after the reveal and they're engaged, they go off on this like honeymoon, pre-marriage honeymoon, where they live in Mexico at a resort. They all meet each other, so you meet the other people you've been talking to who you almost fell in love with. And if they make it through that stage, they get a trial marriage. They live together for 3 weeks in an apartment that the show has provided. And at the end of that 3 weeks, there's a wedding ceremony. And they decide, they either say, I do or I don't. And I will say from the very first season of the show, which is years back now, there is a couple that's married and has kids. Every once in a while, it works.
Every
Mostly
once in a while,
it
works. And it's here in Columbus where there's a shortage of, I guess.
Yes, because they announced it was going to be in Columbus this season, and then they couldn't find enough good single straight men, so they expanded it to all of Ohio. So it's Love is Blind Ohio, but the fake marriage period is taking place in Columbus. And I was just saying that I laughed out loud last night when there's one of these dramatic moments between one of the couples and they're in their Columbus apartment. And she says, where were you last night? And he says, I went to Grandview. And it just cracked me up. I was all ready to talk about a book and you got me talking about Love is Blind.
Well, it sounds like The Dating Game. You know what that show was?
Yes,
decades ago.
But this old enough to remember The Dating Game.
But this is deep because they really do get to know each other. I mean, people tell each other things that they've never told anyone before, which is why. I mean, I say this as someone who fell in love through letters once in the early 90s.
Yeah, Jane Austen. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So there you go.
All right. Well, this is the book show. Let's underwrite that and ask Kathy Rose if you're able to give us a recommendation now for something to read.
I am. And this is a very involving book. It's not a new one, though. It won the Pulitzer Prize in Literature or in Fiction in 1965. It's called The Keepers of the House by Shirley Ann Graw. And she wrote it in, she's a Southern author. She wrote it in, it was published in 1964, which was just 4 years after To Kill a Mockingbird. And this is a book that you spend time with and you get comfortable with and then you sink into it. It is the story of a granddaughter named Abigail telling the life of her grandfather, William Howland. And they owned the Howlands are known in the early 20th century for having owning a lot of land and owning this house through the centuries. Not centuries, through the decades. No, centuries. Five generations. So it goes back to the American Revolution. But anyway, at the very beginning of the book, the first couple pages, you know that something is wrong. She is at the house and she's basically saying, I am going to save my family. I'm going to save it from this county and from this city, from save our reputation and demand who we are. Essentially, the book is about her grandfather who fell in love with his housekeeper, who was Margaret, and she was a black housekeeper. And this is mostly what we read is in the 1920s about his story. But we find out that he came back to the family. He was married. He lived in the house. Why he became a widower, how he raised his daughter, Abigail. You get this wonderful life story. And then you hear how he meets Margaret. And then it ends. And then it goes into a section about Margaret. And we find out where she grows up in the bottoms. And she is... Well, I won't go into the detail there. And then you get to another section, and it is the granddaughter of William Howland, and she's the one that has been shocked by something. I will just say that. But the story is not what you are going to think it is, because there is a true relationship between Margaret and William. And this is the Deep South. This is the Deep South in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. And William is a respectable man. He is highly regarded. And I'm going to tell you a scene that happens early in his life, where he's going to the post office and he's picking up a copy of the New York Tribune that his daughter requested to have a subscription to. And he walks in and the postmaster looks at him, and this is during Prohibition, the 1920s, and looks at him like, this can't be right. And everybody in the feed store is looking on and watching how he's coming to get a Yankee newspaper. And William Howland, he does not say, my daughter wanted a subscription. He doesn't. He goes, yep, that's right. That's for me. Well, everyone is staring at him. There are remarks made. I'll just say that. And William Howland goes and stands out in the middle of the street and sees everyone staring at him. Someone's running down to the hotel to start the gossip. And he says something that I can't say on the radio and laughs. So I want to say that because that is who he is. Now, when you're reading the story, you are more involved in the family. This is like, I want to almost say it's like old-fashioned storytelling, but there's something rich about it. There's something about the characters. You love William. You love his daughter, Abigail. You love his granddaughter, Abigail. And it is when you get to the point where you begin to see, well, I don't want to say it. All I'm going to say is that I got to the end of this book, and I will tell you, I was not shocked. I was stunned. And it's an incredible ending. It's an incredible story. And there are so many things I want to say, but I can't give it away. I don't want that beautiful, fluid family story and this incredible man and this incredible family.
It's great that we can rediscover something that was written 60 years ago. It obviously got a lot of very positive attention. Mm-hmm. You said she won the Pulitzer Prize in 1965. What brought it back?
Well,
Has it ever been out of print?
Oh, no, it's still in print, or it came back because there is a copy at the library. I read it because I had a copy in my library, a first edition, something in me just reached for it. I was looking for a kind of book that, like I just described. And I thought, I'm going to check on Goodreads and see what's going on about this book. And it has thousands of readers that have given it more than 4 points or 4 stars. And that's when I thought, and then I did some more research, and I also saw the library had the new version of it, not new like this year, but it's a different cover than what I have.
Remind us of the title and author again.
It's called The Keepers of the House, and it's by Shirley Ann Graw, G-R-A-U. And you will love this book.
Did she go on, was this her first book? Did she go on to a career?
Yes, I have a couple of her books. Her first ones were not before this, were okay from what I read about from the critics. This one set her apart.
Yeah,
and I'm wondering if it's also because she grew up in Alabama, and you can tell by the richness of the environment, the people. There's a feeling about the book that you sense that she knew it well.
That's a recommendation from Cassie Rose, who was WOS's book critic. I recommend her blog, thelongestchapter.com. And quick pick us, Chrissy.
Okay, so this quick pick is not a new one. It came out last year, but I finally got my hands on it to read it. It's called The Names by Florence Knapp. And this one, it disappears very quickly from the hold. So it's still very much a popular book. It is about our names and what does our name set us on a certain life trajectory. So this is about a woman named Cora, and she suffers horrific mental and physical abuse from her husband. He's a charming, handsome doctor, and no one suspects. But we meet her in 1987 as she is walking to the registrar's office to officially name her son. And the husband says, remember, we're going to name him Gordon after me. She doesn't love that because he's horrible. She likes the name Julian. And then her daughter says as they're walking, well, I think we should name him Bear. And so we have three timelines, depending on which name she chooses. And it jumps every 7 years. And he's a very different person based on the name. Cora is a different person. And then the daughter, Maya, is also a different person based on the trajectory of this naming. It is fascinating. There is description of horrible abuse, so know that before you go into it. But I just found it riveting just to see, and she does a great job of separating it, so it's not confusing. You know exactly what name and what timeline. So she puts that at the beginning of the chapter. But it's so hopeful. And all of his iterations, there is a point where he must make a choice. And that part is fascinating about how he gets there and what he does with that moment. But I found it to be hopeful. And there's just so much to unpack with this story. It would be a great book club pick if you're looking for something to read with your book club.
It's called The Names by Florence Knapp.
And this is a debut for her. So I hope she writes more because I will definitely read them.
Is there expectation? Is that part of it, like the expectation that comes with the name? Say, if you were named Michelangelo, for example.
Right, right. Well, and what happens to the timeline when she does choose Gordon is very interesting, what ends up happening.
Chris Hickey, I'm going to ask you something that people ask me all the time, given the fact that I work in public radio. How's the funding at the library now? Because I know it's been up and down for all of us.
How's the funding? I think I don't have the details on that, but you know, if you want to come in and speak to us in the building, we could definitely answer those questions.
I'm just, you know, wanting to make sure we're all okay. You're all open. Everything's going beautifully well. You know,
the books are out there, but
you know, that's been a concern for all of us in these sectors. And we're all still here because you're listening to us.
Yes.
And we're still
here, too.
So that's all good news. Michelle Herman, give us some more good news.
So I'll give you another. This is so not like me. I'll give you another brand new book. This is Not About Us by Allegra Goodman. And let me preface this by telling you something that's going to make me sound like a very petty person, which I can be. Allegra Goodman is a writer. This is her seventh novel. Her first novel, Catterskill Falls, came out in 1998, came out at the same time that my second book came out. And we tread much of the same territory. We're both in our fiction. We're very much domestic writers. We write about relationships, parents and children, marriages, families. She's also Jewish. She's also an East Coast writer. And her first book got an enormous amount of attention and won the National Book Award. And I couldn't bring myself to read it. And I have never read her until now. Yesterday, so I'm not finished with this book yet, but yesterday I took This Is Not About Us out of the library and started reading it. And I am enjoying it so much. So this is an exploration of a contemporary American family. It's very readable. One of the characters says, Goodman writes about one of the characters, family was her addiction. She could not stop loving them. And it's just so up my alley. It's written as interconnected short stories, so each one is its own thing. And of course, I haven't read past the second story, so I can't tell you how they're all linked. But I am completely in with this. It opens with the sisters when they're quite old and one of them is dying. And then it goes through their lives, their children, their families, their marriages. Anyway, I'll come back and tell you how it turns out, but I am really enjoying it. And Allegra, I am so sorry I waited this long to read you.
Allegra, she loved your book, if you're listening. And remind us about March 7th. And give us a little more review of the book itself.
Oh, a review of my own book. So this book was written long before I became an advice columnist, a professional advice columnist. But it probably is what told me that I could be an advice columnist. I hope the book is, I've been told by children that it's very readable. It doesn't pander. It doesn't talk down. It would be best to be read, especially with younger kids, with the parent, because questions are going to come up. I do my best to define terms like philosophy when it comes up.
You said earlier 8, 9, 10-year-old, and at that age they would read something with their parents. Later on they would not.
Yeah, and it's not for older than that.
Okay.
I mean, the kinds of things that start coming up at 11 and 12, I don't deal with in this book. This is a foundational advice book. And it would work for a younger child if the parent is explaining and giving context to a lot of the material that would be, I think, too subtle for a 7-year-old.
And what is the title again?
A Kid's Guide to Life.
And you will be at Cover to Cover, our friend's bookstore in Upper Arlington.
March 7th, Saturday, between 1 and 2 p.m. I plan to give advice. I plan to bring your kids them ask questions. And my daughter doesn't know this yet, but I plan to have her give advice because she grew up to be a therapist. So she'll be helpful also.
Don't bring your teenagers, but 8, 9, 10, perfect. That's just great.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Michelle Herman. Thank you, Cassie Rose, who is WOAG's book critic. Her blog is thelongestchapter.com. Thank you, Chris Hickey. I'll say hello to all our friends at the Whetstone Branch for the Columbus Library. Quick picks, by the way, are consistent in every branch.
Yes,
make sure we know how that works.
Same ones.
And they come out on Tuesday.
They come out on Tuesdays.
All right. And that is the Book Show. I'm Christopher Purdy. This has been All Sides Weekend Books. Thank you for listening. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.